Stars Over Surrey with Dave Gematis and John Extell from the Guildford Astronomical Society. Welcome, and today, in fact, Dave cannot be with us because it's a blood moon. He has to stay indoors locked in a cupboard, so that's why he's not with us today. But welcome to John Axtell from the Guildford Astronomical Society. Hello, John.
Hello there, Graham. Right. I love that bit about keeping him in a cupboard. Is he hanging upside down? Or
yeah, blood is rushing to his head, yeah, just like the moon. Anyway, I'm sure we're going to be talking about that in a moment. We're also going to be talking about the world of space flight and astronomy, your constellation of the month, what to look out for in the night sky next month, and the events at local astronomical societies. But first, shall we see what's happening then in the world of space flight and astronomy? And we have to start with this amazing apparent discovery of water on Mars.
Indeed. And that is my first topic. We've known about water on Mars for quite some time, in that we can see it locked up in the polar ice caps. That's a mixture of dry ice, carbon dioxide, monoxide ices, and water ice. But there's actually more water ice there than was first thought. And NASA, not that long ago, thought that they discovered water flowing downhill in some craters because it happens seasonally. And that's what they still believe, although some people think, maybe it's just it's dust that's falling down, looking as though it's water flowing. But this one, I think, is pretty incontrovertible. And it's not just a small amount. It's something about the size of Windermere up in the Lake District. So about 20 kilometres wide, but probably only a metre or so deep. But it's subsurface. But it's not water that you or I could get up there and drink, I'm afraid. So
because it's so low, is it about a mile down or something?
That's right. Yeah, but underneath the southern pole, what it is, for it to be liquid, it would have to be very salty. And that stops it from evaporating away and freezing. So it would be exceedingly briny. But it's water. It could be used by future astronauts landing on Mars. There are ways of getting desalination, obviously, getting rid of the briny parts. But also, of course, more interestingly, the possibility for life. If there's water, then there's life. The reason
that
there
could be dangerous, couldn't it, as well? You know, it could be dangerous to for life form to us. You know, bugs and things. We haven't got any protection for.
Well, that's right. So you have to be exceedingly careful when going exploring where there is the possibility of life. And that's one of the reasons why Cassini probe was crashed into Saturn, so that it didn't land on any of the moons of Saturn where we think there could well be life.
And I believe they're saying that though they've spotted this apparent water at this location, there could be many locations on Mars.
That's right. This just happens to be the one that they got the first hint that there might be a lake there, water there, way back in 2012. Now, there's a European spacecraft called Mars Express, and it was that first gave this hint, flying over that area back in 2012. And what they've been using is an instrument called MARSIS, Mars Advanced Radar for Subsurface and Ionospheric Soundings.
I like the title.
That's right. They have to work hard to think up these names, I think, sometimes. But it's using ground-penetrating radar. Mars Express has been there since 2003 doing this sort of thing, but it's concentrated since 2012 on that particular area, which is called Planum Australe. And as I say, it's near or under the South Polar ice sheet, which we can actually be seen through telescopes. I saw it myself just the other night. Now, that ground-penetrating radar, you know, gives a return that has indicated that there is this liquid water there. And it's exactly the same kind of signal that they've already used to detect subsurface water in Antarctica, under the ice sheet, and also in Greenland. And so they know that that technique is correct and works here on Earth, and it's the same kind of instrumentation that they're using up over Mars. So it would be, as you say, dangerous for to Earth-like microbial life, but it does raise hopes that there are more reservoirs like this in other locations, perhaps in more temperate latitudes, warmer than at the poles. No reason to conclude that the presence of subsurface water on Mars is limited to a single location. And we already know that the Red Planet was awash with water. Vast oceans covered virtually the whole of Mars billions of years ago. So it's a fascinating concept that water is there, and it could perhaps be somewhere that harbours life. At least what it does, it focuses future investigations into an area for further study.
Really very exciting news, isn't it? Well, a lot of people, if you're listening for the Friday night edition of this, are getting excited about the blood moon tonight.
Ooh,
obviously,
indeed,
it's all happened if you're listening on Monday night or to the podcast.
And we will be talking about that when we get to what's up for...
of course.
For
but you've got other news, haven't you, about the
indeed, moon? Indeed, but about the moon. We're talking about the possibility of life on Mars, maybe in these lakes. A new study has revealed that there could perhaps have been life on the moon in the very distant past. We know that now the moon is an arid, desert-like place in the sense that it's very, very dry, absolutely no possibility of life on the moon at the moment. But simple forms of life could possibly have thrived on the moon after it formed. It formed about 4 billion years ago. And 3.5 billion years ago, there were quite active volcanoes on the moon. And people at Washington State University, together working with University of London, Birkbeck College, and they've been looking at studies, or rather studying information sent back by space probes to the moon and lunar samples brought back by the Apollo astronauts. And we know that there are millions of tons of water ice on the moon. We do know that now. They're in the shadows of craters at the poles, the north and south pole of the moon, plus water that's actually locked up inside lunar rocks. But they believe that water perhaps existed as liquid water when the moon and its volcanoes was giving off large amounts of superheated volatile gases, which would have included steam, you know, from its liquid interior. So that could have formed pools of liquid water on the lunar surface. Although the gravity of the moon is much, much lower than the Earth, so if you'll remember seeing the Apollo astronauts bouncing about with great ease, but at the time the atmosphere could have been quite dense, so to prevent the water from boiling off. Also, if the moon, when it was young, had a molten core, it would have had a dynamo effect within that core, which causes a magnetic shield, a magnetic field would have been generated. So that would have protected life forms from solar flares, cosmic radiation, and so on. So it's another fascinating concept that maybe there was life on both the Earth and the moon at the same time. Now they're now, though, so we're not going to find any selenites, as they were called.
No.
living on the moon when we next get there.
We just might find a few footprints from a few previous explorations.
Yeah, yes. That would be nice. Yeah, yes, indeed. Yeah. Yeah. So it's intriguing. There's no evidence that life did exist then, but the possibility that it could have existed really is quite intriguing.
We are taking steps forward, aren't we, in our knowledge?
Absolutely. It's a fascinating time to be studying all of this.
And I see recently it's been announced about some moons on Jupiter.
Indeed, yes, going from our moon out to Jupiter, our largest planet, of course. Now, when I were a lad and you learnt about the planets, and I learnt that Mars had two moons, that's still the count. Saturn had 9 moons. Oh, I think that's up to 69 now. But Jupiter had 12 moons. So these 12 new moons, which have just been announced, bring the total up to 79.
Goodness, 79 moons.
Satellites for Jupiter.
Do any of them bang into one another? It sounds crowded.
Indeed, that's one of the things that they've just discovered, because of these 12, 11 are what they would consider to be normal outer moons, and one that's a bit of an oddball. Astronomers have discovered these 12 extra moons more or less by chance. They were... You might have heard, Graham, about something called Planet X.
I have heard about Planet X.
Planet X is a hypothesized planet that would account for some orbital perturbations.
Right.
The orbits of the known planets and also these Kuiper Belt objects like Pluto and Sedna and Makemake, these are hugely distant objects. They don't quite match up to where we would expect them to be. And so some scientists in, I think it's Berkeley in California, have said that there must be another planet, another massive object out there causing these perturbations. That's now in doubt, though. Another study has said it's just a combination of gravitational effects will cause this. However, people have been using, some of the large telescopes down in Chile to try to look for this Planet 9. And Jupiter just happened to be in the part of the sky where they were looking. And so they thought, well, whilst there, let's have a look at Jupiter, see what else we can find. And so they've discovered these extra moons. Some of them are what we call retrograde moons, in that they orbit Jupiter in the opposite direction to the prograde, the normal moons of Jupiter. So 9 of these new moons are part of a distant outer swarm of moons that orbit in this retrograde orbit. 2 are part of a closer prograde group, the same direction of the planet's rotation, that means. But the new ones take about a year to travel around Jupiter. The 9 outer ones take something of the order of 2 or more years to orbit. But this extra one, this real oddball, it has an orbit like no other known moon of Jupiter. It's also the smallest moon. It's only about a kilometre in diameter, which is tiny. Mm. So it's very inclined in its orbit. And it takes about 1.5 years to orbit Jupiter. So this one has an orbit that crosses these outer retrograde moons. So as a result, head-on collisions could occur. It's thought that maybe this oddball satellite is maybe the remains from some larger object that has indeed had some head-on collisions. It'll cause them to break apart and grind down to dust. They've come up with a name for it. It's been proposed to call it Valle Chudo. and that's the Roman god Jupiter's great-granddaughter.
Apparently. Well, how appropriate. Great-granddaughter. Chip off the old block, by the sound of it.
That's a good phrase. Chip yes. and old block, yeah. But she's the goddess of health and hygiene.
Oh, is that right? Oh, so it'd be a healthy place to go. Yes. Open up a health spa there. Right.
Let's move on to something that is, I'm afraid, disappointing. After all these good news of happy discoveries and so on, you'll know, of course, about the Hubble Space Telescope that has been up there for a long, long time and a wonderful success. But it will need replacing. And the telescope that has been intended for orbit, in fact, 2018, it was the James Webb Space Telescope. But that's had a huge series of setbacks, some of them technical, some of them financial. And in fact, NASA have said that some of them have been human error as well, things going wrong. And it's been put back again, this time to no earlier than the end of March 2021. So that's you know, a great shame. It's going to be much, much bigger than Hubble. And the James Webb Space Telescope, named after a former administrator at NASA, has a folding out set of mirror segments. They're like petals that will form a mirror. So that is hugely technologically difficult to do, because it will be launched folded and then unfurl once it gets up into orbit. But one of the big problems is going to be that you can't fix this one like we fixed Hubble. When Hubble went up into orbit, you may remember that there was a problem and a shuttle crew had to fix an optical device, effectively a pair of glasses, onto the instruments to correct the faulty mirror. And now it works fine. But they could do that because Hubble is in an orbit that the space shuttle could just reach, low Earth orbit, only a few hundred miles up. This one's going to be a million miles away.
Wow, so you've got to get it right, really.
Absolutely.
I'm sure the wait will be worth it.
Yeah.
It'd be a shame to rush.
That's
and
right.
Take any risk whatsoever.
Got to be absolutely sure.
Yes.
I mean, the...
Presumably this is going to give us far better imagery. It's
going to
be a step
absolutely.
Change.
It is. It's an order of magnitude different in terms of, as you say, a step change. But where it's going, well out of our reach once it gets there, is called a Lagrange point. It's going to the... There are several of these. That's where the Sun's and the Earth's gravity forms a balancing point, a gravity well. So it means that once you get it there, it can stay there without the need of fuel to keep it in position, other than the fuel to help it to move, and that's done with the gyroscopes as well. I mean, the cost of this has spiraled. There was an $8 billion cap on it set by the American government. You go above that and you're at risk. And it's already gone up to $9.66 billion.
Wow.
So any delay increases the cost, of course. Mm. So it would be terrible if it were to get cancelled.
Indeed.
It's very
there's so much investment in it already, I would hope not.
Yeah.
And we would owe the Americans a great debt of gratitude for this investment.
Oh, fantastic. Yes, indeed. Now, the sorts of things that it might be doing once it gets there is looking for... far distant planets, exoplanets, and studying them in far more detail than we can at the moment. And there has been one of these exoplanets, and we know of thousands of exoplanets now, but for the very first time, astronomers have actually imaged one in the act of forming. What happens is that when a star is born, it collapses out of a cloud of gas, which starts spinning. So the centre of the glass, the gas cloud, condenses into a sun, and nuclear fusion starts when you get the right temperatures and pressures, and the star ignites and lights up. Now, the rest of that gas disk and gas and dust starts to form into planets. And we've seen these gaseous disks elsewhere with the star, new star forming, but for the first time they found one of the a planet now forming in one of these gaseous disks. So it's not that far away, in astronomical terms, and it's a relatively young star, only 10 million years old. And they think that the planet itself is probably only 5, maybe 6 million years old. So it's probably several times the size of Jupiter, and is likely to have a very cloudy atmosphere. And people have been looking for this sort of thing for a long, long time, and so it's exciting that this has now finally happened. And it's the Max Planck Institute for Astronomy who have done this in Germany. The planet is about as far away from the sun, from its sun, as Uranus is from our sun. So it takes about 118 years for that planet to go round its star. It's thought to be about 1,000 degrees centigrade, so very hot. It's still in the act of
slightly
forming.
Warmer than here at the moment. Then.
Yes, yes. no hosepipe band there. Should have thought of that for Mars. Have they got a hosepipe band on the
probably
Martian have,
yes.
Lake? Oh, dear. So we believe... And it is, of course, a theory that our own planet and the others have formed in the way that I said, by gas cloud collapsing, planets growing by accretion as little objects lump and clump together, collide with another and gradually get bigger. So it's going to be fascinating to study how this particular planet is called PDS-70b.
It rolls off
the tongue. Trips off the tongue,
yes.
Doesn't it? Yes. And it'll help astronomers to understand more about this process. Now, one of the main spacecraft that we've been using to discover exoplanets has been the Kepler space mission. Now, that has had an extra lease of life when it was thought to have been lost because one of its gyroscopes failed, but they ingeniously found another way of getting it to point in the right direction by a combination of the gyroscopes that have been left. But sadly, that mission is now coming to an end. Kepler has now signed off. It's now stopped its mission to look for new exoplanets, and I think it was only last month when I reported that it had just found yet another 80 exoplanets. So it's closed down. All it's got to do now is just send its last set of data. And then that's it.
It'll be a sad moment, really.
It is, yes, considering how many, it's numbers in the thousands, the number of exoplanets it discovered,
really?
And ones that are still to be confirmed as well. You know, they're candidate exoplanets that you have to watch for several times to make sure that the orbit is confirmed.
All fascinating stuff, John. And what about Elon Musk and his SpaceX? What's happening there?
Oh, we can't go without mentioning SpaceX. We do every programme, I think, because they're such a fast-moving company. Thing to I think that is of particular interest at the moment is that they've just shown their capabilities by launching two Falcon 9s from different launch sites, but within 3 days of one another. And when you think of all of the administration and logistics that goes into this, it shows the capabilities of the company. The first one was on the 22nd of July, and that was a Falcon 9 upgraded one going off from Cape Kennedy in Florida. And that was launching something called Telesat, which is a communications satellite. And it's the biggest one of these that's ever been launched, 7.8 tonnes, setting a record. And that goes up into what's called geostationary orbit, 22,000 miles above the Earth's surface. So it's apparently
in
the same place,
right,
more or less.
As
yes,
the Earth rotates, right.
So so hard on the heels of that, that was 20 seconds, so on the 25th, they used the California launch base of Vandenberg to launch, I think it was 10, Iridium satellites. Iridium satellites are used for, again, for communications, but that's more the mobile phone type of communications. So a very good feat. The other thing to report about SpaceX is they've upgraded one of their boats. I'm sure you're aware that SpaceX try to reuse as much as possible of their components. And they successfully land their boosters now for reuse. But there are still some parts that get thrown away. And that includes the fairings, which are around the satellite itself. But that gets jettisoned on its way up when we're far enough out of the atmosphere that it doesn't need any aerodynamic shielding anymore. And those fairings fall down and are just lost at sea. They have got a boat that tries to catch them with a whopping great net, built out on either side of the boat. And the boat just belts along at great speed and tries to catch them because obviously they can track these fairings with GPS. They know exactly where they are and can predict where they're going to come down. But they've now increased the size of the net. It's a monstrous thing.
Wow.
Goodness
this
knows
is
how
incredible,
many tennis
isn't
courts.
It? Yeah. Sounds like one of these fairground games. You can never actually get something in the net, isn't it?
That's right. So hopefully we'll be getting some pictures of them successfully catching these as they come fluttering down. Now, of course, one of the competitors to SpaceX, in many ways, is Jeff Bezos' company, Blue Origins. And we talked about that company last month because they're well on their way to offering the public hops into zero gravity, suborbital hops. Now, they've just succeeded in a milestone that was essential for them to get accreditation so that they can do this, and that was to launch one of their capsules and then demonstrate that the crew escape part of the vehicle works okay. So that's the rocket that can take the capsule away from the booster were there to be a problem during launch. So that was successfully done just over a week ago. Now, this, of course, is all American, but we shouldn't forget our European side of the launching. And we are part of the European Space Agency and will remain so. That's got nothing to do with Brexit. But the European Space Agency have just successfully launched the Galileo mission. An extra set of satellites for the Galileo project. So that's four further Galileo satellites have been put into position. That brings the total up to 26 now. So we should be in a position to be live with Galileo by 2020. And Galileo, of course, is the European competition, if you like, to GPS. Now, although the European Space Agency is our membership of that would continue, it's the funding of Galileo that is causing the arguments, and that once we are out of Europe, then would we have access to that? And I do hope that we can get that one sorted. also at European Space Agency, they are working on a new generation of booster rockets. There'll be a heavy lift one, the Ariane 6, which is the successor to Ariane 5, the one that launched these four Galilean satellites. One of the essential parts of Ariane 6 is the booster rocket, a solid booster rocket, and that is the biggest solid rocket booster, solid fueled booster, that is the biggest one in the world, and that has been successfully test fired for the very first time. So that's going to be used not only for Ariane 6, but also for a lightweight rocket launcher for smaller, inexpensive satellites, and that's called the Vega C, and that essentially is going to be that solid rocket booster with a second stage on top of that. So I suppose that we shouldn't really forget Britain when we start thinking about Europe and launching possibly from Britain. That has now taken an extra step forward. I mean, previously the government had already selected that were we to get involved with companies that are using space plane type operations, then the airport down in Cornwall will be the one that would be used. That has now been that concept has now been extended by the selection of a Scottish site for getting into polar launching. And there's a British startup company called Orbex, together with an American company, Lockheed, who are now thinking about using Lockheed Martin, I should say, that Scotland would make a good place from which to launch relatively small boosters, but taking small satellites up into particularly polar orbit. So I'm just trying to remember the name of the site. It's a difficult one for me to pronounce, so forgive me, Scottish listeners. Amhoin Peninsula is the best I can do.
Well done.
But it's a very sparsely populated area, and it's overlooking the sea. So it's within the county of Sutherland, if you know that area. So they could have that up and running by the early 2020s. Government has agreed to put money towards the development of this as a possibility. So, yes, it'd be good to see Britain up in space. And I nearly forgot, Graham, whilst talking about the European Space Agency, I meant to mention the ESA's spacecraft called Gaia, which I've already mentioned has been, in previous episodes, has been studying millions of stars in the Milky Way in great detail in terms of mapping their position, their movement, the direction of their travelling, and seeing how that changes over time. Now, data from this analysis has revealed that a long, long time ago, possibly 10 billion years or something along those lines, the Milky Way collided with another galaxy, a much smaller body, and it's been nicknamed the Sausage Galaxy. But that hit headlong our galaxy, and was shredded by our galaxy. The stars from that Sausage Galaxy will have been absorbed, but Because of the way they entered our galaxy, their orbits around the common centre of gravity of our galaxy are exceedingly long and sausage-shaped, hence the name Sausage Galaxy.
I was wondering.
And these have only just been discovered. So that dwarf galaxy, you know, fell apart quite quickly as its stars merged and helped shape our current Milky Way. Now, the Milky Way has got quite a few small satellite galaxies, the like the Magellanic Clouds that you might have seen if you've been down into the southern hemisphere, the larger and smaller Magellanic Clouds. But it has other tiny dwarf galaxies that have been shredded as they've come close to it. So this is yet another one of those. But it's just showing what a powerful instrument this Gaia spacecraft happens to be. No doubt much more to be learnt from it in the future. So, Graham, that's about it. My report on spaceflight and astronomy news and what that I've found of interest over the last month.
Thank you, John. Fascinating month. Stars over Surrey, constellation of the month. So, John, what's the constellation of the month?
Well, for August, my constellation of the month is Lyra, or Lyra, some people pronounce it, L-Y-R-A. It's quite a small constellation, but its main star is called Vega, and that makes up one of the three corners of the summer triangle. That's composed of Vega with Altair in Aquila, the eagle, and with Deneb, the main star of Cygnus, the swan. Lyra is a fairly easy constellation to find, so if you look for this very bright star, Lyra, not that many stars in it, but it includes one of the most fascinating double stars, because it's actually a double-double. The naked eye, this star just looks like a single star. A telescope will show it as two stars, but an even more powerful telescope will show each of those stars is made up of a double itself. So four stars in one. But it's also the host of a couple of Messier objects as well, a globular cluster, and M57, the Ring Nebula, which is the remains of a star that has died, thrown off its outer gases, outer atmosphere, and all that we can see now is this torus, this ring of gas glowing away. It's one of my favourite objects. So well worth finding Lyra and having a look. And of course there'll be more detail in that in the video clip.
The month ahead for Stars Over Surrey. So now, John, we look ahead to see what listeners can see in the night sky over the next month.
Indeed. As I've already said, you find the summer triangle to help navigate your way around the night sky. Got some good constellations coming up, apart from Cygnus, which is almost overhead at 10 o'clock, which is well worth a look. You'll find that that's straddling the Milky Way that we've talked about earlier. From Cygnus down to Cassiopeia and Perseus, the Milky Way will stretch that far, heading towards the northeast, whereas going from Cygnus down to the southwest, you'll see the Milky Way stretching along towards Sagittarius and the teapot asterism, where one of the several planets can be found that are available to the observer in the night sky. So let's move on to talk about the planets then. The Mercury isn't visible till the last week of August, when it becomes a morning object. So last week of August, look for it in the east-northeast, rising just before dawn. But Venus is still a brilliant evening object in the west-northwest, setting a couple of hours after the sun. It's getting closer to the Earth, so it's increasing in size, but its phase will be diminishing. So it's observers, if you get a good power binocular, or better still, a telescope onto Venus, you should see it during early August as a half moon sort of phase, but that will be gradually turning into a crescent. But it will still stay about the same brightness of -4. As it's getting closer, it gets brighter, as the shape gets smaller, so there's less light coming from it, but it stays constantly about -4. Mars is going to be phenomenal. It's at its largest and brightest for well over a decade. Sadly, though, it's relatively low, so you need to find a good horizon to see it in the southeast or the south. It's rising in the southeast, but its highest it gets is about only 11 degrees in the south. You can see it, either side of midnight, but it's very, very bright because it's so close to us. Magnitude is -2.8, so that makes it brighter than Jupiter, which many people would think of as the second brightest planet after Venus. Mars can actually be brighter than Jupiter. It's visible throughout August, rising increasingly earlier as the month goes on. Tonight, for example, it will be rising at 9:39. But by the end of August, it will be nearer 9 o'clock, it will be rising. So that makes it easier to find. Now, the reason that it's so bright at the moment is because, like Earth, Mars has an elliptical orbit. And every so often, Earth and Mars come together as we orbit the Sun. But sometimes Mars will be at its furthest part of its orbit when the Earth catches up with it, and the Earth might be closer to the Sun. So on average, we say that Mars is something of the order of 51 or so million miles away from Earth at its closest point. But because of the coincidence of Earth at its furthest point of its orbit, more or less, and Mars at its closest to the Sun, it's only about 34 million miles away.
That's a lot of difference.
That is, yes, indeed. So that means that it's that much bigger, and as it's that much closer, it means it's going to be that much brighter. And much more detail, in theory, could be seen on its surface through a telescope. I managed, as I said earlier, to see the southern polar cap through the telescope not so long ago, but a few days ago, in fact. But unfortunately, there's been a huge dust storm on Mars, which has wrapped its way virtually around the whole planet. Now, that is slowly subsiding, and so some of the surface detail can now be seen, but it's not as detailed as it would normally be. Anyway, let's move on to Jupiter, which I've mentioned as the next planet out. Still an evening object in the south-southwest as night falls, but again, fairly low, about the same elevation as Mars. But easily visible. It's now at magnitude -1.9, and that will stay with us again until late August. Saturn is there as well, much, much fainter at magnitude +0.6, low in the southern sky, but the rings are tilted very nicely towards us. So it's easy to see the rings and the gaps within the rings if you've got a good telescope. Even binoculars will show that it's not a disc, that it's an oval sort of shape, and if they're powerful binoculars, you might be able to resolve that into the planet and its rings. And Saturn will be with us for the whole of August. Uranus and Neptune are again now visible to us as morning objects. Uranus, in theory, visible to the naked eye if you've got perfect eyesight and no light pollution at all. But generally, we call it a telescopic object. And that's to be found in the south, east to south, best at the end of August. Neptune, again, is in the south-southeast, rising as an evening object as the month draws on. If you want to do some lunar observing, then the best time in the month would be around the 17th, when the moon is at its first quarter. So look at the moon a few days either side of that for best results. Or very early August, if you're a morning person, because the third quarter is equally good for looking at the moon. But by definition, that means it's early morning. And if you want to do deep sky observing, the fainter objects, then of course it's best to do that when the new moon is in the sky. So that's the 11th. So you don't have any moonlight washing out the fainter objects. Now, as we're talking about the moon in August, I really ought to talk about the moon in July when this broadcast goes out. In fact, tonight. And as you've already mentioned, Graham, tonight we have a blood moon.
Indeed, indeed. And Dave's in his cupboard hanging upside down, so he's out of the way. But it's going to be quite a sight if one can see it.
That's right. It's going to be the longest total lunar eclipse this century. It just happens to be that the position of the moon's orbit takes it through the very centre of the Earth's shadow. So that means it's going to remain in the Earth's shadow for the maximum amount of time. The Earth's shadow is cone-shaped, and so sometimes when you get a total lunar eclipse, it just goes through a narrow part of that cone. Here it's going right through the middle. Sadly, this total eclipse starts tonight whilst the moon is below our horizon here from England. From Britain. So it starts at about 8:15, and the moon doesn't rise here until 6 minutes to nine, and that will be in the southeast. So the sun sets a little while after, just about the same time. So as the moon rises, it will be fully eclipsed. Now, you might think, well, if it's in the shadow, that means it will be invisible because there's no light reflecting from it. Well, that doesn't take into account that the Earth has an atmosphere, and our atmosphere gets lit up by the sun. All of the blue light that gets from the sun is scattered in our atmosphere. That gives what gives us a blue sky. So that leaves largely reddish light. So when you look at the edge of the Earth from space, you'll see this reddish, orangish ring around the Earth. And it's that light that gets refracted round that will fall on the moon. So it comes up with this coppery colour. I think I'd call it copper colour.
I understand it
red.
Can be, yes, it can be different shades depending on the conditions.
That's right, yes. That's right. So they're hoping, as it's in the deepest part of the shadow, that it will be even more red than normal. The last one I saw a few years ago, it was a nice coppery colour. But even if you don't have a sight of a horizon to see the moon actually arising, fear not, because the eclipse will last until half past, well, totality ends at about 10:15. So it'll last for another hour after moonrise. But you then get into the partial phase. So even if you haven't been able to see the totality, you might see the partial eclipse of the moon as it moves out of what we call the umbra, you know, the main part of the shadow. So that continues until 11:20. So it gives you a good opportunity to see at least part of tonight's total eclipse. So watch out for it. Where I'm going, I shall probably pop down to the water meadows between Purford and Ripley, where you get quite a good horizon there.
Oh,
so
right.
I shall go down and try and photograph it from there, perhaps rising above Newark Priory.
Well, that would be rather lovely, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it should make a... I like photographs with a bit of context in.
Yes,
so
indeed.
Something like
yes.
Trees or whatever. Mm. So the ruins of Newark Priory should make that a good sight. If, of course, the projected thunderstorms and clouds that would accompany that don't get in the way.
What a shame if the weather did break tonight.
We have a saying in amateur astronomy that the importance of the event is inversely proportional to the chances of seeing it.
Yes,
what with British weather.
Yeah, there we go. And of course, if you're listening to this on the Monday Night Repeat or indeed the podcast, it's all happened.
Indeed,
it's
and we hope that you had a good eclipse.
Indeed, we do, indeed.
The night isn't just going to be, though, just the moon, because Mars will be quite close to the moon, you'll see the coppery-coloured moon and a bright red Mars. So that together should make quite a wonderful sight. And if you've got a telescope out, then switch it round to Jupiter, because the great red spot transits the middle of Jupiter at about 10:25. So a good telescope will show you that. You'll also have Saturn visible. Venus will have probably set by that time, but Saturn will make a good sight. There's going to be an International Space Station pass tonight as well. So that's a very bright one going over almost directly overhead, 188 degrees above. It rises in the west at 11:06. Gets overhead 3 minutes later, and then sets in the east 2 minutes after that. So well worth getting out and give them a wave. The six astronauts up there, and there's also going to be what we call an iridium flare. I mentioned that Ariane took 4 iridium satellites up. Well, those are replacements for the current set of iridium satellites. Now, the current set are satellites with massive solar panels, and those panels reflect the sunlight and give a big flash. The satellite will be almost invisible, start to appear, and then there will be a big brightening period, and then it will fade again. Well, one of those will be going off. It's the satellite Iridium 45, and that will flare at 11:16 tonight. That will be fairly low, about 24, 25 degrees above the horizon in the north east. So watch out for that. So quite a few events, as well as the total eclipse of the moon. Okay, Graham, one other particularly interesting event to tell you about in August is on the 12th, and that's a meteor shower, and best seen from around 9 o'clock onwards in the evening, but perhaps the best time really is going to be the early hours of the 13th, after midnight. And this is the Perseid meteor shower. So get out there, get out in an easy chair, chair, lay back, have a warm drink or a whiskey or something like that. No need for binoculars. Just lie back and enjoy. If it gets cold, then take a rug. But point towards the east and just look at the heavens above you, and you'll see meteors streaking around. You know, maybe one every, you know, two or three minutes. So nice and interesting to do. To help people to find planets, I often, who haven't done so before, I often use the moon as a guide. So on the 14th, the moon is only 5 degrees away from Venus in the west. On the 17th, the moon is again 5 degrees away from Jupiter, this time in the southwest. Use the moon again to help you to find Saturn, only 5 degrees away on the 21st. And Mars is close to the moon, a bit further away, 6.5 degrees away in the southeast on the 23rd. Now, other things for August, we still might see noctilucent clouds, these night-shining clouds on the northern horizon, but there's a comet that people might be interested in trying to find. It's called Comet 21P, and it's named Giacobini Zinner after the people that discovered it. It's a faint comet, but it's it should be visible in binoculars. And I've published a finder chart to help people to find it, and that will be in the WhatsApp PDF slides that you can download from the website. If you can find your way to the constellation of Cassiopeia during August, then the comet is passing close to Cassiopeia. So it might be your first chance of finding a comet. You'll see it as a faint greenish blob with a little bit of a small tail behind it. Meetings at local astronomical societies, because it's August, many of them have holidays. So there's nothing at Guildford, at Croydon or at Ewell. But Farnham, keep the flag flying, on the Tuesday the 14th of August, they have a talk called How to Weigh a Universe by, I think he's one of their own members, Colin Stewart. And of course, as true armchair astronomers, as many are, we have on television The Sky at Night on Sunday the 12th and Thursday the 16th of August, both on BBC 4, 10 o'clock and 7:30 respectively, and the episode is called The Death Star. So this month the team asks how much of a threat our sun poses to life on Earth. Maggie Adarin-Pocock and Chris Lintott explore something called coronal mass ejections, and why space weather, as it's called, hasn't actually been too much of a threat to our planet, and it's all to do with this magnetic sheath that surrounds us. Now Lucy Green, Professor Lucy Green, from down at Holmbury St Mary, the Mallard Space Science Laboratory, is involved in this program, and she finds out how the European Space Agency's solar orbiter, which is about to be launched, how that's going to withstand the sun's fierce glare and what the mission may discover. So that's it. That's my look at the night sky, Graham.
Thank you very much, John. I've really enjoyed sitting in for Dave this month, and thank you for all those fascinating insights.
It's my pleasure.
Fascinating time, isn't it?
It absolutely is.
This show is going to be repeated on Monday night at 11 p.m. and is available after transmission as a podcast. The podcast will also have more items than we could fit into the broadcast. And the next edition of Stars Over Surrey will be on Friday the 31st of August at 7:20 and repeated the following Monday night at 11. Stars Over Surrey with Dave Jemetis and John Axtell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, why not keep up to date with the Sound of Surrey by listening live at brooklandsradio.co.uk or through our free mobile app.